welcome everyone to tonight's Citizens Climate University. It's a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobbies that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics relating to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and tonight's topic is going to be November 2021, lobby training number one, focused on primary asks and some general legislative planning. Join CCL's Vice President of Government Affairs, Dr. Danny Richter, for a training that's going to provide us up to the moment insights on the dynamics of this crazy Congress that we find ourselves in and how we can most effectively use our time in our meetings and really plan out that agenda. So this is the first of two recommended trainings for those planning on joining their local lobby 2021 meetings. And so with that though, let me introduce our esteemed speaker and then we'll jump right into tonight's presentation. Dr. Richter joined CCL staff back in 2013 after 5 years as a volunteer. Dr. Richter completed his PhD, getting paid to do research on all seven continents. As CCL's first staffer in DC, he established our DC office where he's been responsible for our overall legislative strategy, clarifying the details of CCL's policies and interacting with other groups in DC, and has overseen our research program through all of the great studies that you've come to know and love. Danny, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Brett, and thank you everybody for being here. For tonight's talk, we'll leave plenty of time for questions as usual. I have three learning goals as we start this. Number one is I hope you will end this talk understanding the current state of our politics and the role CCL can play within it. I hope you'll understand the different sensitivities to reconciliation between Republican and Democratic members of Congress. And last, I hope that when we get to the end, you'll understand the primary asks and how they help us fulfill our role in the policy ecosystem. So those are my goals for tonight. The way I hope to achieve those is, number one, I'm going to start us off with what I see as the current state of play in Washington. Then we'll go to the primary ask for Democrats. I'll cover the primary asks for Republicans. And then we'll bring it together with summary and conclusions. And as I mentioned, we'll have plenty of time for Q&A and discussion. So before we begin that, I thought I would start off with just grounding us in the reconciliation process. A lot of you have heard this before, but it's so weird that might as well hear it again. So let's look at budget reconciliation briefly. What is budget reconciliation? It's a process that allows specific budget-related legislation to bypass the filibuster, and that's the key, bypass the filibuster, so that it can pass with just 51 votes in the Senate. So that's budget reconciliation. But as I said, it's a weird process. It can only be used once per fiscal year, and there are also some restrictions on it. So what can be included? It's budget reconciliation. So Senate procedural rules follow the Byrd rule, and the Byrd rule is designed to limit what can pass through reconciliation through 51 votes to things that have a direct impact on the budget. So they should not produce a change. So you're excluding things that do not produce a change in outlays or revenue. You're excluding things that where the budgetary effect is merely incidental. So it could have an incidental budget effect. The primary policy change is something much bigger. That's not allowed. And it can't be something that would increase the deficit beyond 10 years. So these are some of the restrictions of budget reconciliation that limit what Congress can actually do. Again, it comes back to this, the Senate simple majority. That's why it's such a prize here. But because it is that lower vote threshold, it ends up being a very partisan exercise. And over the past decade, it has been used to do some pretty big things by both parties when they've had unified control, when they've controlled the House, the Senate, and the presidency. And in each of those cases, it's been a very, very partisan exercise. And so in 2021, we find ourselves in a situation where the last Congress did not pass a budget reconciliation bill. So the last fiscal year. So there's actually two opportunities to do reconciliation this year. The first one was taken in February. And what we've been talking about since August, well, before then, but it really, really kicked up into high gear in August. That's the second opportunity. And President Biden wants to pass a $3.5 trillion plan, although today he issued a framework for a more modest $1.85 trillion plan that addresses climate as part of the goals. So that's where we are with budget reconciliation. So now I think let's get to this current state of play. And here I want to walk us through the past couple of months of what I consider to be significant events. And I want to walk you through this timeline because I think where we've been affects where we are today. And if you're going to connect with your offices in your meetings in a few weeks here, knowing where they've been and how they got here is going to help you connect. And so I want to review these salient milestones because I think that will make you more effective. So let's begin in August with the passage of the bipartisan infrastructure bill in the Senate only in the Senate. This came about after 2 months of really intense, all-consuming negotiations. The final vote was 69-30. So you had all Democrats plus 19 Republicans voting for this. You had a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate who were voting for this infrastructure bill. So it was really quite significant. And the key senators involved, there were a group of 10 senators on the Democratic side. It was Sinema, Manchin, Tester, Warren, and Shaheen. On the Republican side, it was Portman, Cassidy, Collins, Murkowski, and Romney. And this really was the last time Congress was really pursuing regular order. This has not been sent to the president's desk, as I'll talk about, because it hasn't passed the House yet. And there are reasons for that. But anyway, this is where I think the timeline really starts, because very shortly after that, you have a memo on August 9th sent by Senate leadership. So that's Chuck Schumer to Senate Democrats outlining what they wanted to achieve through reconciliation. So you achieve the bipartisan infrastructure package, pivot immediately to reconciliation, and this is when committees start drafting legislation. And that memo is really the most detailed piece of that we can refer back to from the Senate so far, even back in August. And I'll talk about that a little bit more. And I also want to remind us about what we were doing during all of this. We were having our big pushes, our three-week campaign of calls and emails dedicated to the Senate. That was from July 20th to August 10th. We knew that reconciliation was coming, and we really wanted to make sure that senators knew that they had a lot of constituents who wanted to see a carbon price and reconciliation. We then did that in the House from the very next day, August 11th to September 1st. And there again are the wonderful work that so many of you on this call did, calling your friends, your colleagues, your family, and getting them to act as well. I really do think that had a big impact, but that's what was going on then in the Senate. Now, also with that August 9th memo, Leader Schumer released this pie chart, which is really quite interesting. This is a pie chart that shows what are the different policies, climate-related policies, that are in this memo that Democrats want to try and tackle through reconciliation, and how many emissions do they get us? How many emissions reductions do they get us? And there are a couple of things that were really interesting about this that I want to highlight. Number one is that when you added all this up, you only got to 45% emissions reductions by 2030. And President Biden's goal was a 50% reduction below 2005 levels by 2030. So if you added up everything that was in reconciliation at the start, you fell 5% short. That's the first thing. The second thing is if you look at the biggest slice of that pie chart, it's the clean electricity payment program plus clean energy tax incentives. Then you have clean vehicle incentives as the second biggest piece. And the third biggest piece is the methane fee. So three pieces, really four, because that biggest thing is both the clean electricity payment program and the clean energy tax incentives. That's two separate policies. And I'll talk about that more in a bit. So you add up all that's in reconciliation, it falls a little bit short. Then moving forward in time, you have so this is the memo, then the Senate actually passes the budget resolution. And these were very nonspecific. And so if you actually read the text, the instruction is directed at committees, different committees in Congress. And so, for example, the Energy and Natural Resources instruction for reconciliation is just an instruction of $198 billion. So it's just a number. Here's another. Finance received an instruction to reduce the deficit by a nominal amount of $1 billion over 10 years. So this is the language. And so they don't say the Energy and Natural Resources Committee shall have jurisdiction over a clean electricity payments program. That is not in the budget resolution. They're not actually saying that. That is only in the memo that Leader Schumer issued. So that's, I think, useful to understand about the enabling, the really the starting gun for budget reconciliation. It's that budget resolution. Now, let's keep on moving forward. This is something that we didn't really know at the time, but it became significant at the end of September for the House. But in late July, anticipating reconciliation, there was an agreement, a signed agreement between Leader Schumer and Joe Manchin. Behind me is the center of the universe these days. It is West Virginia. This is the New River Gorge Bridge in West Virginia behind me. I like to stay focused on what's important here. So I've got West Virginia behind me. But in that signed agreement between Senator Manchin and Senator Schumer, Senator Manchin said that he would not promise to vote for anything that spent more than $1.5 trillion in reconciliation unless it was for deficit reduction. And he also said that he would not start thinking about reconciliation or acting on it until October 1st. And so this is what Manchin and Schumer agreed to back at the end of July. All right, so keep that in mind. I'll tell you how that came through. So now let's switch to the House. So the Bipartisan Infrastructure Framework, or the BIF, there was a disagreement between moderates and progressives in the House. And on August 23rd, Speaker Pelosi agreed to a joint vote on both the bipartisan infrastructure package that passed the Senate, 69-30, and the reconciliation package. Those two were joined. And the agreement, the compromise between House progressives and moderates, was to only vote on both of those, because progressives really wanted a lot more done in reconciliation. They wanted to see what the Senate was going to do before they basically released the hostage of the bipartisan infrastructure package. And so they want to see what the Senate is going to do. And we are still in this standoff between moderates and progressives, in particular in the House. And so moving forward from this agreement on August 23rd, they said they were going to vote for this at the end of September. But before they got there, the next big piece is a leak. So the leak was on September 3rd. I think this was actually Finance Committee staff who deliberately leaked this, is my sense. But they leaked a list of pay-fors, policies that they were going to use to pay for the reconciliation package. And a carbon price was one of them. And in what made a lot of us very excited, the details of the leaked document suggested that they were thinking about a $15 starting price, increasing over time, that it would be paired with payments to low-income households, and it would include a border carbon adjustment. So here we have confirmation that even though it wasn't in Schumer's outline, the Senate Finance Committee was considering a carbon price. And that instruction that I read off, a nominal $1 billion, it was nominal because basically Finance Committee gets to do whatever they want, because not whatever they want, but they have wide, wide jurisdiction because they are the only committee that can raise revenue. Finance Committee is the only committee in the Senate that can raise revenue. And so they were giving wide, wide latitude to pay for this. And so there is where the carbon price was, and that is where it remains. So let's keep moving forward in time to September. This was the deadline when the House was supposed to vote on the bipartisan infrastructure package and their version of reconciliation. So in the lead up to the end of September, there was the House was having committees all the time. They were really trying to put together their version of the reconciliation bill as quickly as possible. But they didn't have an agreement. And so we get to the end of September and they don't have an agreement, but the rule that the Rules Committee passed that they had to vote on both these policies by then. So to solve this, they just didn't adjourn. So we had this really strange situation that I commented on in one of my earlier videos where while it was October 1st in the rest of the world, in Congress, it was actually still September 30th. So that was a 48-hour day or so. And then at the end of that day, they still didn't have an agreement. And so they extended the deadline to Halloween, which is, of course, this weekend. Right now, it's looking like they will again have to punt. And then the day after this, that's when the Schumer-Manchin agreement was announced. So it was only the House needed some clarity from the Senate, but Manchin, who is necessary for all of this, agreed that he wouldn't even start working on this until October 1st, which really never happened in the House. So that agreement really put the House in a bind and made kind of very strange situation kind of inevitable if everybody stuck to their stated positions. Then we moved into the next crisis, which was the debt ceiling. This was agreed to be lifted on October 12th. However, it was a short-term increase. If you remember the headlines, Republicans in the Senate didn't want to force the standoff. And you could say that Mitch McConnell blinked. That was kicked until December 3rd. I don't think he's going to blink again. And so December 3rd, Democrats need to figure out a way to anticipate that and really raise the debt ceiling on their own. So that would seem to be the deadline for all of this is December 3rd. So we will see how things develop. And then very recently you have, this is just a couple of weeks ago, Manchin is reported as telling the White House, I cannot support a clean electricity payments program. And if you go back to that document that Leader Schumer wrote, this was assigned to the committee of which Joe Manchin is the chair. So if the chairman doesn't want to do this, it doesn't happen. And so there was a lot of angst and hand-wringing. But then you have this quote from the chairman of the Finance Committee, Ron Wyden, and he said, "While I strongly support the clean energy payment program, it's important to note that the overwhelming majority of emissions reductions come from the energy tax overhaul in our Clean Energy for America Act." And I want to return to that pie chart for a moment. If you remember, there were really two policies in that biggest pie chart. It was the clean electricity payment program and the clean energy tax incentives. Those clean energy tax incentives is what Chairman Wyden is referring to. And so it turns out that most, if we're to take his word at face value, most of that 41.9% is coming from those clean energy tax incentives. It's not coming from the clean electricity payments program. And so that explains that. And this more or less brings us to the present day. It was not unexpected that the clean electricity payments program would not make it into the final package. It always had big questions about was it reconcilable. There was a publication by Resources for the Future, a very well-respected think tank in DC, that gave a carbon price a lot of attention. It was looking at a clean electricity payments program, the Clean Energy for America Act, that's Wyden's package of tax incentives, again together. And it was looking at a carbon price. What would it take to get to Biden's goal of a 50% reduction below 2005 emissions by 2030? And I think that after the removal of the clean electricity payments program, a carbon price is now being viewed in a different light, both by progressives and by moderates, by others who really want to see us get to a 50% reduction by 2030, it's being viewed more favorably. So there remains a realistic chance for a carbon price to be a part of reconciliation. I do want to just highlight here, you know, we've been pushing for a carbon price for 10 years, and it's really only the last few months that we've been pushing for it through reconciliation. It has always been our preferred method of going through regular order, but we wanted to have a say in this process coming up. We didn't want to let this process go through and have things be done with climate and to not have a shot at getting a carbon price. So that's why we engaged with this. We would have rather done it through regular order. So that's where carbon pricing stands. Where are things at now in both the House and the Senate? First, let's consider the House. The House does not expect their version of reconciliation to be the final package. If you go back to the first reconciliation package that passed in February, the House passed a version. They sent it to the Senate. The Senate passed their own version. That's the one that became law. And so already this year, the House has had the experience that they do something and what matters is what the Senate does. And that's disempowering if you're a member of the House. And so that's informing why you see the House progressives using the bipartisan infrastructure framework as leverage, because they feel disempowered that their voice is really going to be heard on reconciliation. We did not have resolution by the end of September. The Senate's timeline for a framework that House progressives would buy remains unclear. I thought it would be the end of this week. I think that they were really trying to push to get Biden to Glasgow with something. You saw today that $1.85 trillion, that's from Biden's own reconciliation framework. That is different than the Senate reconciliation framework. We still don't know what the Senate reconciliation framework is going to be. We still don't know what's going to be in it. But Biden's version, I think that he needed that to go to Glasgow. It doesn't include a carbon price. It doesn't include a methane fee. It just includes a lot of spending. I think that that's his effort to go to Glasgow with something and hopefully restart focus in Congress. But regardless, where we are today is the bipartisan infrastructure framework and the House version of reconciliation are still tied together. Their fates are still tied together. So that's where we are in the House. Let's look at the Senate. Congress is still working. The Senate is still working through their framework. And I do want to just highlight, there's a lot of media attention, but if you think about what this actually looks like, is, you know, you have reporters chasing senators as they leave one meeting, and then those senators are about to go to another meeting, and the reporter reports on what that senator said offhand at that meeting, but they're going to just go to the next meeting and discuss that again. We're in an extremely dynamic situation where there are real meaningful discussions going on in the Senate right now. And so what you're getting from reporters, you're saying, oh, well, this is what the river looks like now, but then the river just keeps on flowing and it's a different river. All the water going through that river at that now is different than it was when they reported. So right now, what you're seeing is the media has a particularly blurry view of what is actually happening in Congress. And in fact, this process is so extraordinary, it's so leadership driven, that even members of Congress and their staff are a little bit confused about what is actually happening and what the positions are. That is how fast things are moving. That is how quickly the discussion is changing. This is what an active negotiation feels like. Nobody really knows what's going on. So that's something you should bear in mind. Also, we've been getting notes from our friends in the Senate that there may be two phases in the reconciliation framework rollout, the Senate reconciliation framework rollout. And a carbon price might not be so visible in the first phase. It might not be explicitly mentioned. It might not be explicitly excluded. And so for us, that's going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult to not be able to know. It is the strong sense of our friends in the Senate that the longer a carbon price stays under the radar, the better the chances are for final passage. So just got to kind of white knuckle it through this process. So now let's talk about primary asks. Let's start with Democrats. So for Democrats, it's really important to get inside the headspace of the office you're going to be meeting with. And if you're meeting with a Democrat, they've really only been thinking about reconciliation for at least the past 2 months. And so in order for you to be effective with your Democratic member of Congress, you're going to have to talk about reconciliation. And so the primary ask for House and Senate Democrats is include a strong carbon price in reconciliation. And in the rest of this text, there are really five or six important points that I lay out here. And I hope that you'll be able to make these with your member of Congress. And so those points are, number one, we, like President Biden, want to get to a 50% reduction below 2005 levels by 2030. We also talk about how flexible carbon pricing is in a negotiation, an active negotiation. You need to be flexible. And this is a flexible policy. You can bend it and torque it in different ways and still get significant emissions reductions. That's a useful tool in negotiations. These are also emissions that are cost-free. And what I mean by cost here is, what is the final price tag of the reconciliation package? Because the emissions reductions come from the price and not how you spend the revenue, that actually creates a lot of revenue. We've been hearing happily that in the discussions around the carbon price, they want to use the bulk of it as a dividend. So we don't want to say that this actually helps you pay for it, but we can say that it is cost-free. You get emissions reductions without having to spend money. Another big point in here is you get big emissions reductions early. We're talking double-digit emissions reductions after year one, just months after this goes into effect. And then that helps drive lives saved, particularly in frontline communities. And it helps complement other policies, because other policies that take longer to spin up to get those emissions reductions, they're working from a lower baseline. And so that means that overall, they're gonna bite deeper into cumulative emissions that we need to achieve to solve this climate crisis. And then finally, really, a carbon price is a requirement for the US to be considered a leader on climate in global negotiations. The rest of the developed world already has a carbon price. There are several large economies that are not ranked by the UN as being developed economies. They also have carbon prices. So we really are in a delicate position where we could be excluded by a large number of countries, and we really can't be considered a leader on climate until we have a carbon price. So these are the main talking points in the primary ask for Democrats and for Republicans. So why this? Why not something else? Well, I want to remind, there is a need to contextualize carbon pricing within reconciliation. And what I mean by that is, we've been talking about a carbon price in regular order for over a decade, and your member of Congress might not automatically assume that we also want to see it in reconciliation. So you need to make that explicit. We want to make sure that we're sharing this main message, even with supporters of a carbon price. And of course, by you taking this message there, you're showing constituent support. If you know that your member is already a big champ of a carbon price, even in reconciliation, you can take that same supporting ask and you can say, how do we do this together? How can we help? And so maybe it's, you know, this a conversation of, this is what we're bringing to all these offices. How do we help you get a carbon price in reconciliation? That would be if your member is a known supporter of a carbon price in reconciliation. Otherwise, you shouldn't assume. And this message is particularly important with moderates and progressives. Democrats, what is between a moderate and a progressive Democrat? I guess that would be rank and file. I'm not sure. There's Democrats, maybe, but anyway, we're trying to get to, in particular, moderate and progressive Democrats. So that's why we're making this ask with Democrats. And let's remember, this is a very, very fast-moving environment. I really can't predict the legislative landscape by lobby week. There is a potential for the primary ask to change. I hope not. I really don't want to do that to you, but if this doesn't make sense, say they've already passed the carbon price in reconciliation, it would not make sense to bring this. And just know that we will be tracking things closely and we'll get to you with any updates that we have as soon as we can. And then you always plan for flexibility in the meeting, but now you might want to plan a little bit more about how to be adaptable as you start forming your teams and figuring out how you're going to approach your Democratic members of Congress. Flexibility is going to be really extra important this year. Now let's talk about Republicans. So for Republicans, while Democrats' headspace is reconciliation, it's just the opposite for Republicans. Please do not bring up reconciliation in your Republican meetings. Why? Because it is such a partisan process. If they are so inclined and you bring up reconciliation, they can completely shut down that meeting right away. And so you are not able to have a productive discussion with your Republican members. And so that you can envision, what would this look like? Well, you say, well, I want to talk to you about a carbon price of reconciliation. They say, we don't have any role in reconciliation. The Democrats are completely excluding us. They're being super partisan. And I don't really have anything else to say to you. So, I mean, that's how it could go if they were so inclined. So please don't talk about reconciliation with your Republicans. Instead, we are suggesting, for the sake of a productive meeting, supporting asks, what are usually supporting asks, making those one of your primary asks with Republican members. So for the Senate, I'll be talking about supporting asks next week in greater detail. And for the House, I would recommend the Growing Climate Solutions Act. That has already passed the Senate, and that is one of the closest things to getting over the line. And so I think that in the interest of having productive meetings with Republicans and having them moving in the right direction on climate, I think that that's probably the biggest bang for your buck in the House. And let's talk a little bit about the strategy here. Why are we doing this? Why aren't we having something more in line with the carbon price? Well, we are thinking after reconciliation, it's going to be a really different landscape. We're not sure what it's going to look like. There's so much in there for climate, and it's so unclear what it's going to look like. We want to get forward momentum with Republicans now. We are going to have divided government again. At some point, Democrats are going to lose the House. They're going to lose the Senate. They're going to lose the White House. And we want to have a track record with Republicans of them saying yes to us. We want to have a track record with Republicans of us helping them achieve their climate related goals. And we do actually have a pretty good track record of getting climate wins with Republicans. And so I want to just review that real quick. I'll just throw that up on a slide here. We have the SCALE Act was a supporting ask in June. That is now included in the bipartisan infrastructure framework package. So once the House passes that, assuming they do, that's law. That's the law of the land. And so we can take some credit for that. The BEST Act and the USE IT Act and the Climate Ready Fisheries Act, those were all passed as part of the December COVID relief package that was signed into law by President Trump. Big reason why those were included is because we were advocating for them. The Climate Solutions Caucus, of course, is a big example of that we worked really hard on in terms of getting Republicans pointed in the right direction and going back even further, the Republican climate resolution. And you look at this and you really also see, I mean, that Republican climate resolution, all it did was say that climate change is real, humans have had an impact, and Congress should do something about it. But getting 17 Republicans on board with that in 2015, that was a really big deal. And so to be where we're at now, where we have John Curtis out of Utah forming a conservative climate caucus, and for that to get it in a few weeks up to 68 members, Republican members of the House, that is a very different world. And the way I'm thinking about this is now you have 68 Republicans who are walking in the right direction. Our job this Congress is to get them to walk faster. But I would much rather be encouraging people to walk faster in the same direction than to try and convince them to turn around and walk in the opposite direction that they've been going. That's a lot harder. And so the fact that we are encouraging the Republicans who are walking in the right direction to move faster, that is a huge progress, and that is what these primary asks for Republicans are all about. It's getting them to move faster in that same direction and being able to continue working with them, have a track record of working together for when they are again in the majority. So now let's summarize here and come to some conclusions, so we'll get into Q&A. Things are happening right now. This is a very exciting time, but it does require unusual adaptability. I mean, that $1.85 trillion number, that was in today's paper. Biden announced this framework today. So having to figure out what does this mean? How does this relate to the Senate framework? Oh, it has no relation to the Senate framework. That was me being adaptable, and everybody on this call is going to have to demonstrate comparable adaptability before our meetings in November. Democrats are really thinking only of reconciliation, and we need to meet them where they're at because they're tired. This is an all-consuming thing for them. They're trying to achieve goals, not just on climate, but on other priorities. We need to meet them where they're at. And Republicans are not at all happy about being excluded from reconciliation. It doesn't matter that it's not a surprise. It doesn't matter that they did this to Democrats in the recent past. It matters that today they are excluded. And if they want to, and you bring this up, they could easily turn this around and just shut down a meeting and prevent it from being a productive meeting. And so we are trying to keep our meetings, our primary ask, focused on the production director taking productive direction, taking positive steps forward, getting them to walk faster in the direction that they're going. And for those who still need to be turned around, turning them around. So that's what I want to talk about.
Well, Danny, thank you so much for being here, making yourself available. I know that all of us are deeply comforted from your wisdom, from your perspective, and the whole work that the whole DC team is putting into helping us prepare for probably the most volatile November lobby day, if not lobby day or week period that we've had yet. At this point, if you have anything else, please go to the forums. A reminder that we are tuning in the same time, the same channel next Thursday for part two, focused specifically on supporting asks and some final guidance, given that we'll have another week of the crystal ball to look into. But for now, stay safe out there, everyone. Have a wonderful, wonderful week of preparations. If there's anything that we can do, please reach out. Don't be a stranger and keep up the inspirational work each and every one of you are doing.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.